Thank you for inviting me. Let me just get started. I did tell her beforehand, I had no idea what to say about Porphyry, so I just combined, I really did steal from the title of the seminar. So in any case, but there's different ways you could, one could take this, and I took it in one way, and so I would be very grateful for feedback on this. Concealed within a fragment of one of Porphyry's less studied works, the Against Boethus on the Immortality of the Soul, is found a particular passage alluding to an inventor of mechanical devices, imitating the movement of the planets, whose Olympian and divine nature was overlooked by his fellow humans in their self-centered focus on external appearances. This is a rather large extract on number one on your handout. I'm referring in particular to that little second paragraph, as well as the third. The reference to the inventor marks an odd twist at the end of a list of human achievements vaguely reminiscent of the so-called Ode to Man, sung by the chorus in Sophocles' Antigone. Not only had humans constructed a boat to cross the sea, discovered the medicinal arts and the art of kindling fire, and charted horoscopes, but one had, quote, contrived imitations of the works of the demiurge. A human figured out how to craft on Earth the conjunctions of the seven planets along with their motions, imitating heavenly phenomena through mechanical contraptions, end quote. The identity of the inventor is somewhat complicated by Porphyry's further remarks that the man had persuaded the many to suppose him to be of mortal form in spite of the fact that his intellectual achievements had shown him to be divine. But it seems likely that he has Archimedes in mind. Earlier authors who had described Archimedes' engineering feats had claimed that he seemed superhuman. While there were later imitators, such as Posidonius the Stoic, and the astronomical clock of the first century Tower of the Winds in Athens, and the roughly contemporary Antikythera device discovered by underwater archaeologists exhibit a high level of mechanical knowledge, Archimedes continues to be seen as revolutionary in his mechanical planetarium, or armillary. The admiring responses he received in literary sources made him a fitting exemplar for Porphyry's argument in defense of the immortality of the soul based on its similarity to divinity. Porphyry's allusion to the inventor may have been only a passing one, but it is indicative of a wider, more complex engagement with historia on the part of this 3rd century philosopher and polymath. Indeed, in another fragment from the same originally 4-book treatise Against Boethus, he made the bald claim, and this is in the second extract on your handout, he made the bald claim that both our innate conceptions and, quote, the things of history unambiguously establish the immortality of the soul, end quote. What precisely he had in mind by the sweeping gesture to history is quite unclear, given the dearth of fragments from Against Boethus. But it is the offering of such a claim that is arresting. The appeal to historia, in this case, what would amount at least to anecdotal allusions to the great discoveries of human history, should not be taken for granted in the writings of a Platonic philosopher. And labeling him a polymath, even if he is one of the greatest of late antiquity, does not alleviate the problematic nature of such an appeal. If a soul's life in a body was to be likened to a drunken stupor or death by Plato, what could be the use in concerning oneself with the hazy shadows of an inebriated condition? Porphyry himself had likened the material world to the darkness of a cave, the ascent from which was the goal of the true philosopher. I'm alluding here to the On the Cave of the Nymphs. His master, Plotinus, was characterized as being embarrassed of inhabiting a body. He refused to sit for his portrait with an observation that a visual likeness did not belong to those things worth looking at, axio theatum. If Plotinus' physical appearance was not worthy of sustained attention, how much less so should have been the memories of bodies past? The following discussion seeks to address the ways in which historia found a useful role in Porphyry's corpus before turning to this problematic status of historia for the philosopher who walked in the ways of both Plato and Plotinus. The term historia and its cognates occur in a wide range of Porphyry's writings, from exegetical treatises on Homer's epic poetry to his Against the Christians, from his defense of vegetarianism to his aptly named Historia Philosophos, the best-known portion of which has come down to us as the life of Pythagoras. In its noun form, historia most frequently designates either the material available for one's study of the past or the task of the inquiry itself. When, in the On Abstinence from Killing Animals, Porphyry declared that history is full of examples of ancient sacrificial practices, he seems to have been alerting his reader to a wealth of written sources on ancient sacrificial practices that would elaborate and confirm the points of his argument. That it could refer to texts from or about the past is evident from a fragment of the Against the Christians, where he remarked on the Phoenician Sanchuniathon's process of, quote, compiling all the ancient historia from the civic memoirs and the priestly records, end quote. Though here it is the subject of the texts rather than the texts themselves that receives the designation of historia. The texts are, rather, the hypomnemata and anagrapha from which the historia was drawn. But when he claims that history has handed down the memory of ancient sacrificial practices, Porphyry seems to have particular texts of individual historians or other intellectuals in mind, since he cites Theophrastus, Asclepiades of Cyprus, Manetho, Apollodorus, Sanchuniathon, and Philo of Byblos, and others. And that's just in Book 2, and we're going to return to at least Theophrastus in a little bit. Historia was thus the collective repository of past accounts of past practices. Yet it was not limited to texts or even historical investigations more broadly. As with its classical ancestor, historia in Porphyry could designate other fields of knowledge. The term also occurs with reference to geographical inquiry in the essay on the Cave of the Nymphs, the field of medical knowledge in the Homeric Questions of the Iliad, or philological investigation in his commentary on the Timaeus. An even more general valence is conveyed in the rare occurrences of the adjectival form historetas, or with the alpha privative on historetas. For instance, in the third book of his On Abstinence, he writes that the person of good intelligence acknowledges that animals possess understanding, while, quote, the ignorant person who has done no research, an historetas, about them is carried away, collaborating with his own aggression towards them, end quote. The term here applies to the person who has done no research, as Gillian Clark has translated it, in the areas of scientific observation and philosophical treatments of the nature of sense perception, memory, and understanding. He cites Aristotle, Plato, Empedocles, Pythagoras, and Democritus. It probably also includes historical research such as would provide anecdotes like the one about Apollonius of Tuana's ability to understand birds, or Marcus Crassus's ability to call his pet lamprey. In its verb form, it usually designates either the reports of past events or peoples that had come down to the present or the present reporting of one's investigations into the past. I've only been able to find one instance of the verb historein being used to designate a non-historical act of reporting. In the Two Garris on the Ensoulment of Embryos, Porphyry notes that Hippocrates had recorded historein the differing periods of the formation of the embryo following conception for male and female babies. Otherwise, the verb seems limited to reporting of a historical nature, of what we would call a historical nature. The chronographer Castor had recorded the size of Diospolis with its 100 gates. Various sources had reported divergent accounts of Pythagoras' birth, upbringing, or incidents of his mature life. Others had reported the sacrificial practices or historical anecdotes of various groups, and so on. Porphyry himself ends the main biographical section of his Life of Plotinus with the statement, "This is the life of Plotinus, which we have reported, historetai hemin, or which was reported by us." Porphyry thus not only drew upon the works of historians or those who had left written records of significant individuals, nations, or scientific or geographic phenomena, he himself participated in the activity of doing historia by compiling the odd, sometimes mysteriously arranged reports and observations that made up the life of Plotinus. While he never described the related piece that has received the title Life of Pythagoras as the product of his own historia, it certainly was, and its place within the larger, now fragmentary philosophical history should not be forgotten. In all of this, there is nothing surprising, as far as I can tell, in the range of significations of historia and its cognates in the writings of Porphyry. It was a broadly applied word in classical antiquity, and Porphyry's late antique adoption of it remained well within that traditional usage. Whether Porphyry's work as an historian was deemed to be a project tangential to or separate from his work as a philosopher is best answered if we first examine the ways in which historia could function within a philosophical argument before turning to the epistemological issues such an engagement might raise. Space does not permit any attempt at providing an exhaustive account of the role of historia in the arguments of the various works in which it is found, and in any case we are checked in such an enterprise by the prohibitive effects of working with fragments in many instances. Of course, I can write a whole book on fragments too, so it doesn't mean it needs to be an end of discussion. For the purposes of the present discussion, though, I would like to focus on abstinence from killing animals, which allows us to observe the fruits of historia within a single, rather lengthy text, at least lengthy in comparison to Porphyry's other writings. Our inquiry would be complicated in the case of other pieces for which historia was no doubt central. While Porphyry tempers an allegorical approach with an interpretation of Homer's descriptions of both the Cave of the Nymphs and the River Styx, especially if my tentative reconstruction in my book on the Styx is more or less correct, it is difficult to determine exactly why Porphyry defends such an approach in the two essays dedicated to these themes, but Mark Edwards will probably answer this next week. Likewise, the philosophical history is of obvious significance for appreciating the ways in which he saw himself as performing the task of history writing. Yet it seems quite difficult, if not impossible, to arrive at sure conclusions about the philosophical position such a history was meant to affirm, or even the basic problems it was intended to address. In other words, for me at least, that is a text that has all sorts of problems, most significantly wrapped up in its sources and why they quote what they quote from various books. In contrast to these other works, we are on firmer ground when we seek to locate the purposes of historia in the On Abstinence, a four-book treatise that seems to be missing only the last couple pages. In this work, history and philosophy fuse and separate in an undulating rhythm. It may be somewhat overly schematic, but one notices a greater attentiveness to the data of historical investigation in books 2 and 4, in contrast to what we might consider more strictly philosophical argumentation in books 1 and 3. Book 4 marks something of an ethnographic tour de force, which I have commented on elsewhere, and so will offer only a brief summation here. And then the bulk of the paper will be taken up with Book 2. Claiming that some critics of vegetarianism have been corrupted by pleasure, Porphyry remarks that they adopt specious arguments that seek confirmation from bad history. These individuals are, quote, unfamiliar with true history, and a rebuttal requires going through dietary customs of various nations in order to prove that every race abstains from at least some kinds of animals. The enumeration of the various animals prohibited by each nation, when combined, exhibits a comprehensive prohibition of all animals. In other words, the philosopher who takes the best of each nation, abstaining from some animals, will seek to arrive at a condition superior to each nation, meaning that they will abstain from all animals. Furthermore, groups of holy people, in particular priests from each nation, abstain from all animals and thus provide a model that should be imitated by the true philosopher. Quote, a man who engages in philosophy should prescribe for himself as far as possible the holy laws which have been determined by gods and by people who follow the gods. One should either imitate the priests or obey all the legislators. End quote. Throughout Book 4, Porphyry calls as witnesses native authors, or those who were reporting native sources, who provided literary representation for the people in question. He drew on Dicaearchus and Plutarch for the Greeks, Chaeremon for the Egyptians, Josephus for the Jews, Neanthes of Cyzicus and Asclepiades of Cyprus for the Syrians. Both of those don't seem to be native sources, but it could be argued that Asclepiades is, because he's writing about the Syrians via an ancient Syrian king who moved to Cyprus, namely Pygmalion. So, Eubulus and Pallas for the Persians, they're not native sources, I don't know what to do with them, and Bardesanes for the Indians. An historiographical picture emerges from these disparate sources that highlights decline from an ancient vegetarian, or at least low-meat diet, in some national histories, and clearly marks out members of certain priestly castes as embodying exemplary ascetic discipline in their completely vegetarian way of life. While we lack his conclusion, Porphyry's use of historia in Book 4 of the On Abstinence is clear, to set the record straight in the face of criticisms that asserted the universal consumption of meat without good historical warrant. Such historical correction may have been initially prompted by the bad historical arguments of his opponents, but it also allowed him to elaborate the metaphor of the philosopher as the true priest of the god over all, by attending to the dietary habits of priests from other nations. Like these priests, the philosopher perpetuated practices of the greatest antiquity and resisted the pressures of contemporary moral decline. History and experience had, Porphyry explained, demonstrated the injustice of eating meat. He says this at near the beginning of Book 4. This coupling of history and experience will deserve further attention later, but first we must turn to Book 2. I am going to bring in experience in a bit. The earlier engagement with historical themes and materials in Book 2 differs from that of Book 4 in marked ways. While Book 4 dedicated itself to investigating the dietary habits of the most significant nations of Porphyry's world, at least east of Rome, Book 2 sought to respond to the critics who connected meat-eating to the religious life shared by all. Porphyry's argument observed that animal sacrifice was a later addition to earlier, more acceptable, non-animate sacrifices, and furthermore, even if the gods were pleased with animal victims, this did not entail the appropriateness or necessity of eating the victims. Historical research was fundamental to delineating the first half of this approach, but its importance recurs throughout the book. Charting the structure of the book is rather difficult, and there seem to be a couple different but equally fitting ways to outline his argument. For the purposes of the present discussion, it may be best to consider the following outline. I'm just doing this if it's been a while since you've read On Abstinence Book 2 to remind you of some of the main units of thought. Even though I recognize that there is overlap of some of the sections and there are fuzzy boundaries between units of the argument. After an initial preface that presents the problem of sacrifice, there's an initial section that deals with the historical origins of sacrifice in chapters 5 through 11. Then he turns to the quality of sacrifices. He will continue to make provide historical anecdotes, but his focus is to talk about the quality of sacrifices, in particular the simplicity of them and the justice of them, in chapters 12 to 23. Then he will turn to discuss the motivations for sacrifice, in which he finds there to be three, either to give honor, to give thanksgiving, supplication, or as honor, but it's especially honor, and I would argue that actually his long discussion, and if you've read this, you remember this because it's most striking to modern sensibilities, is his discussion of the hierarchy of divine beings and his discussion of good and bad, daimones, etc. I would argue that all of that is part of this section on honor and to whom is honor given, and etc. Then there was a final section on the problem of divination. How are we supposed to tell about the future if we can't look at entrails of animals? And then he will close by a recapitulation of what he calls the undistorted concepts of the many. It's going to be in the first couple that I'm going to focus on, the first couple sections. Porphyry draws on rather different sorts of historical sources as he pursues a robust philosophical account of sacrifice. It is in the first and third sections, in particular chapters 5 to 32, which 5 through 32 don't even follow what I just broke down as segments. 32 ends in the middle of the third, that he invokes Theophrastus's otherwise entirely lost work on piety in such a way as to lead modern readers to see the material provided therein as almost entirely Theophrastian. I do not intend, especially scholars of Theophrastus, the more they find it, the happier they are. I do not intend to offer my own determinations of the extent of the so-called fragments, keep scare quotes around fragments, of Theophrastus here, but I would like to offer a few remarks relevant to our present inquiry. The reason I have to make these remarks is if all of this is somebody else's views and not Porphyry's own, then what I have to say matters a heck of a lot less. So, first, while Theophrastus is explicitly named 8 times, usually in the form Theophrastus says, and then something else, not only is it difficult to know where the Theophrastian material ends, but it may be more limited than often recognized. The key statement is the last of Porphyry's gestures towards the peripatetic philosopher, the last in Book 2. Quote, "These, then, are the main points of the argument of Theophrastus against the sacrifice of animals, except for the myths he included," which thus should give us pause to scholars of Theophrastus who say that the historical anecdotes are the myths of that Theophrastus was supposed to have had, because he's explicitly saying he's excluding the myths. I have added or summarized a few things, end quote. This is at that chapter 32 that ends the so-called Theophrastian material. How much Porphyry has added and the nature and degree of his abbreviation cannot be ascertained with any firmness. Bouffartigue and Papillon have worked carefully to identify what they deem to be Porphyrian interruptions in the extracts from Theophrastus, but these may mark only the more obvious of what might have been a wider range of insertions by Porphyry or reworkings of his source. Second, a series of observations at regular intervals throughout the sections on the quality and reasons for sacrifice, the second and third sections, promote a picture of Porphyry's thinking continuously enveloping his Theophrastian source. For instance, some statements in the Theophrastian segment refer back to the beginning of Book 2, or even to later material in the On Abstinence. 2.10.4, hopefully nobody's going to look these up, but 2.10.4 restates an assertion from 2.2.1 and 2.11.1 offers a claim that it will be the basic assumption of all of Book 4, that will become a basic assumption of all of Book 4. This need not entail that the material at 2.10.4 and 2.11.1 are not thereby Theophrastian, but it does indicate that any attempt to isolate material as his sources and not Porphyry's own position is highly problematic, if not impossible, in its execution. In fact, it opens the possibility that even larger amounts of material within chapters 5 to 32 are not as Theophrastian as at first thought. An argument could be made that much of the material surrounding these two short passages noted here is not dependent in any direct way, and possibly even in any indirect way, on Theophrastus. It would run briefly like this, and if your eyes haven't glazed over, they will soon, but just I'm going to barrage you, and then I'll remind you of what's going on. One, the Theophrastian material introduced in chapter 5 may end as early as at chapter 8, because in chapter 9 there stands a summary of 2.5 to 8. So if there's a summary, it makes me wonder if the earlier material hasn't ended by that point. Two, the already mentioned two short passages at 2.10 and 2.11 can be connected to firmly Porphyrian material elsewhere in the On Abstinence, as I just noted. Three, the next naming of Theophrastus at chapter 11 starts with, given these facts, Theophrastus was right to say, and then it goes on. As if the immediately preceding discussion was not by Theophrastus, and then only proceeds to state that Theophrastus was right to forbid animal sacrifice, which is sort of the no-brainer of his whole On Piety. Four, the subsequent material is introduced as the sorts of reasons that Theophrastus had provided for his position, but Theophrastus's influence seems to have ended by chapter 16, where Theopompus is quoted. At least I'm following the argument of the French editors on this one. And Theophrastus may not be picked up again until chapter 20, which only recalls that Theophrastus had proven that the earliest sacrifice was non-animate. Five, in any case, if Aristomenes is among those whom Porphyry has in mind as those who have written about ceremonies and sacrifices when discussing the importance of cakes in chapter 19, then Theophrastus was clearly not a source there, since Aristomenes lived at the time of Hadrian, as Gillian Clark has noted. Six, the reference to the wooden tablets called Kurbes at Crete, which limit sacrifice to libations, derives from Theophrastus. It certainly does, because he says, as Theophrastus says. But there is no indication suggesting we take any more of the first sentence of chapter 1 as Theophrastian, especially since the appeal to Empedocles that directly follows is a typically Porphyrian habit. Seven, the next appeal to Theophrastus at chapter 26 may be limited only to the bare claim that the Jews still offer any sacrifice, for again it is unclear that what follows is necessarily by him. Eight, and this is the last of my enumerated points, so bear with me. When Porphyry provides what seems to be a concluding appeal to Theophrastus at chapter 32, which I quoted earlier, it may only be a summation of the material in chapter 32 proper, not all the foregoing material, which itself contained repetitions of earlier claims, such as the claim that the earliest sacrifices were non-animate and the ethical call to limit oneself to plant sacrifices. Many of these foregoing considerations can be questioned, if you even remember them. And closer attentiveness to details and patterns within Book 2 of the On Abstinence would certainly force a more nuanced account of the role of Theophrastus in Porphyry's discussion. Nonetheless, it suggests the need for caution before too quickly assigning large portions of this material to Theophrastus's On Piety. Finally, while there is the peculiarity of the thetization of deltas in the udes and uden becoming uthes and uthen, it is doubtful that such a phenomenon marks Theophrastian orthography, as the French editors claimed. Or they claimed it tentatively. Since both the delta and theta forms occur in close proximity to each other, they didn't tell us this in their introduction. They occur in close proximity to each other, even directly next to each other in the same sentence. And furthermore, there do not seem to be any other stylistic peculiarities here that might indicate anything approaching a direct quotation of Theophrastus's On Piety. Bouffartigue and Patillon claim that the presence of distinctive vocabulary, such as paranomia and hamartia, or that which is contrary to law and error or even sin, and I do wonder if some of those New Testament connotations aren't coming in at this point, indicates the unique position of Theophrastus. They claim that these terms indicate the unique position of Theophrastus. Yet such terminology occurs not only elsewhere in the On Abstinence, but in several other works of Porphyry with some regularity. I have tried to look for other distinctive terminology, like distinctions between ta daimonion and ta theon, both of which could be translated as just the divinity or the divine one. But I can find both usages in what is clearly not Theophrastian material. I had a hunch that ta daimonion might be Theophrastian, and I jettisoned that after study. I would like to suggest, if we're going to look at style, though, that verbal adjectives ending in te-on are distinctive of Porphyry throughout the On Abstinence, and they will run with some regularity straight through the Theophrastian section. If we were going to try to isolate distinctively Theophrastian language, I would suggest, it's a tentative suggestion, is that maybe that would be a marker that this is not distinctively Theophrastian language, it's rather Porphyrian language. The point is it runs throughout. In any case, again, Paquet, the two French editors, the declarations that the usually individualist and atemporal thinking of Porphyry gives way in this segment to social and historical concerns, or that Porphyry's concern is not eating meat, while that in Theophrastian material is not giving cult to evil beings, are not well grounded in the text of the On Abstinence. The clearest arguments that animal sacrifices directed towards wicked daimones is presented after the Theophrastian section in chapters 38 to 42 in a discussion of the doctrines of so-called certain Platonists. It also resonates with Porphyry's demonology in other works, such as his commentary on the Timaeus, and thus should not be seen as somehow distinctively or primarily Theophrastian. With respect to Porphyry's alleged lack of social and historical concern, it is, of course, the basic point of this present discussion to highlight Porphyry's wide-ranging historical interests. While his opponents may have been the provocation for his historical efforts in Book 4 of the On Abstinence, he took this task quite seriously. Even more, his decision to preface the Aeneids with the life of Plotinus, his composition of the philosophical history, and his appeal to historical knowledge in other works like the On the Styx, On the Cave of the Nymphs, Against Boethus, or Against the Christians, as well as the fact that the prevalent, though not exclusive, usage of historia terminology denotes what we would call history, all of this indicates clear historical concerns. Indeed, the historical narrative of a decline from ancient pure forms of sacrifices to later degraded animal sacrifices would seem to mark merely an extension of Porphyry's historical proclivities. I have argued elsewhere that Porphyry does exhibit a strongly elitist stance that is ambivalent towards the vast run of the human population who never saw beyond their embodied lives of pleasure and vice. Such a stance, however, need not be strictly individualist, though his circle of significant others might be necessarily small. And in any case, an individualist need not be possessed of an ahistorical vision. All of these observations indicate that the Theophrastian section cannot in any significant sense be designated a series of extracts or fragments of the On Piety. It comprises a possibly highly reworked and paraphrased assortment of lines of reasoning and historical details from Theophrastus's treatise. We cannot determine how extensive the original work was that has been summarized by Porphyry, nor whether he even had it to hand as he wrote Book 2 of the On Abstinence. Ultimately, he seems to consider the general argument to be his own. This is my whole point in the last three pages. I'm sorry for spending it all on you. While he names his sources as confirmation of the points that he has made, as he had prefaced this section, quote, "Some things I discovered myself, others I took from the ancients and have recorded them, aiming at moderation and what was fitting to the subject," end quote. If the argument of this segment can be said to be not merely Porphyry's peripatetic source, but one that he had adopted and adapted as his own, then it provides a rich fund for developing a picture of Porphyry's historiographical assumptions and proclivities. What this material adds to our understanding of his historiographical framework is threefold. First, Porphyry favors historical narratives delineating decline rather than progress, especially that sort of progress that is presumed behind the Epicurean arguments that he had recounted in Book 1. As with his appeal in Book 4 to another peripatetic, Dicaearchus, Porphyry's appeal to Theophrastus in Book 2 affirms general decline in morality and thinking, whether expressed in dietary habits or in sacrificial practice. Three historical phases are distinguished in the history of sacrifice, or possibly two. Primitive sacrifices of plants in the earliest phases of human history eventually gave way to the sacrifice of humans, either killing them in war or eating them in times of extreme famine. This second phase was followed by animal sacrifices as a substitution. As a substitution for the human sacrifice. Sorry. Alternatively, a simple two-phase account, and it's the one that I think is actually, if we were going to try to separate, and I know I just argued we shouldn't try to separate, but if we wanted to, I have a hunch that a two-phase account is more Porphyrian and the three-phase account is Theophrastian, because it turns out that both are in here. I'm going to argue that he's open to both. But alternatively, a simple two-phase account exhibited that animal sacrifice as succeeding earlier simple plant sacrifices. In either a sort of account, either a three-phase or a two-phase account, a narrative of decline presumed that older was better. A fragment of Hesiod is quoted with approval, quote, "For sacrifice from the city, the ancient law, the namas archaios, is the best," end quote. Later developments marked deviations from a primal purity and simplicity. They stood as expressions of the introduction of vice into the moral history of humanity. Second, Porphyry's discussion contains a complex account of historical causation. What brought about the decline in the purity, simplicity, and holiness expressed in ancient sacrificial practices was a combination of different factors. At one time, unlawfulness, paronomia, led humans into the violence of animal sacrifice. At another time, famine and war are said to be at the root of this transition. Later, Porphyry combines the two. A general neglect of holiness fostered a moral lassitude that easily led to eating flesh in time of famine. Yet, in the earlier discussion, the rise of the opposite evils of atheism or human sacrifice were seen as the result of divine punishment. So this is another possible historical cause. As though fulfilling primitive curses against those who abandoned the ancient plant sacrifices, the divinity imposed the penalty of some humans becoming non-sacrificers and others becoming evil sacrificers. In other words, either atheists or performers of human sacrifice. Since the divine punishment motif does not clearly occur elsewhere as a historical cause, it may be that this is a Theophrastian element, the divine punishment motif, which Porphyry decided not to capitalize on. He included it, but then never capitalized on it. Whatever the case, this picture of human lawlessness, harsh necessity, or divine punishment as coordinate causes of historical decline is further complicated by some anecdotal considerations. For, sometimes, the transition to animal sacrifice was shown to be the result of just an accident. A woman named Clumene accidentally killed a pig, and Apollo exonerated her of wrongdoing, thus purportedly condoning the act. Or it could be a result of righteous anger. A man named Diomas slaughtered an ox that ate a sacred cake. Significantly, Porphyry seems to practice a sort of interpretive openness when looking for the mechanisms of historical causation. Following this last anecdote about killing the ox who ate the cake, he concludes, quote, "These are the particular reasons for the rise of animal sacrifice in Athens. Other people give others, but all the reasons are full of unholy explanations. Most people blame famine. And then he goes on and talks about famine. End quote. In other words, the precise cause or combination of causes mattered less than the inappropriateness of the causes generally and the moral significance of the development. A third feature of interest lends itself to a broader account of Book 2. This is the significance of experience, or peira, as a basis for drawing proper conclusions about the truth or rightness of a position. The term seems to signify not merely one's personal experiences in an embodied life, but also those recorded in texts that one could and should read. Its first occurrence appears in his argument that gods prefer simplicity in sacrifice. Quote, experience testifies that the gods take more pleasure in this than in great expense, end quote. Yet the testimony provided is in the form of an historical anecdote of a man who was commended by the god for offering a pinch of grain in sacrifice, but then, in an act of excess, dumped the remainder on the altar, for which he received divine rebuke. The anecdote has generally been considered to be Theophrastian. The appeal to experience recurs in the second half of Book 2, however, as well as in Book 4, and appears to bear significant weight. After developing an argument on the inappropriateness of animal sacrifice as an offering worthy of only wicked daimones at the lowest level of a theological hierarchy, Porphyry avers that the theologians, and this is a shady group that various scholars have tried to figure out who it is, thus rightly advocated vegetarianism. Quote, and the Egyptian, another person whose identity has been of much concern, including to people in this room, also told us of this, giving a reason which is entirely in accord with nature, and which he tested by experience, peira, end quote. This is followed by the assertion that a soul violently removed from its body remains nearby. It is unclear whether the point tested by experience was the earlier claim that wicked daimones were present wherever flesh and blood were, or whether it was the claim about souls violently removed from their bodies. It is likewise unclear how such a test for either case could be conducted. Because he proceeds to remark that sorcerers, or goetes, had investigated, and there he uses the verb historein, the nature of the wicked soul violently dragged away from bodies, and that they had learned by experience through many examples of the soul's attraction to kindred bodies, it may be that Porphyry is drawing on necromantic experimentation from the obscure underworld of Greco-Egyptian magic. Alternatively, and this is probably more likely, Porphyry provides the example of those who eat animals in order to attain divinatory states. The soul of the animal enters the person, quote, at the same time as the entrance of the animal's body, end quote, and utters prophecies like a god. Whatever the case may be, the role of experience as the object of hysteria here is arresting. It opens up one of the most important declarations of Porphyry for our present inquiry, which I quote in full and is on the back of your handout, or the second page or whatever. So, the philosopher, priest of the god who rules over all, reasonably abstains from all animate food, working to approach the god alone to the alone, by his own effort, without disruption from an entourage. And he is wary because he has fully investigated, notice the variant with historian there, the necessities of nature. The real philosopher has knowledge of many things. He is a historpolon. He notes signs. He understands the facts of nature. He is intelligent and orderly and moderate, protecting himself in all respects. And just as a priest of one of the particular gods is expert and peiros in setting up cult statues of this god and in his rites and initiations and purifications and the like, so the priest of the god who rules all is expert in the making of his cult statue and in purifications and the other rites by which he is linked to the god. Here we possess something of a manifesto of the philosopher who is identified as simultaneously priest and historian. A position of moral, religious, and intellectual privilege is at the heart of this image of the true philosopher. He has thoroughly investigated nature, and has gained full experience, empeiros, of the procedural apparatus of what Porphyry had earlier named intellectual sacrifice. The true philosopher was a historpolon, an appellation drawn from the pre-Socratic philosopher Heraclitus, which originally signified a judge or an investigator of many things, but could in Porphyry equally bear the more focused sense of a historian of many things. The philosopher was to adopt the stance of the researcher and the scholar, whose domain of inquiry was not only the upper reaches of a metaphysical hierarchy, the non-material realm of intelligibles, but also the seething diversity of the physical world and the nature of the interactions of bodies, souls, and other beings in the present as well as the past. The search for the telling anecdote, the cultic minutiae of a ritual no longer practiced, or the distinctive articulation of an arcane doctrine of a foreign priestly caste now became central to the philosopher's task. Both the priest, steeped in the lore of a particular local tradition, and the historian consulting ancient texts were twin roles to be combined in the philosopher, who sought to learn from these domains of knowledge the dangers of the presence of evil powers and the force of temptation, or to discover sterling examples of wisdom and virtue as practiced by historical figures or peoples. Porphyry's On Abstinence was itself a model for this understanding of the philosopher's role as historian of religious phenomena. He had studied the writings by or about foreign nations and the compendia of religious lore, combining the pedantic and the inspired, whether books on cakes or local histories, or the Chaldean oracles or Hermetica, as an integral means of developing his argument against the killing of animals and the eating of meat. Porphyry himself was the priest, historian, and philosopher, the historopolon, who was empeiros in natural and historical phenomena. Such a formulation of the role of the philosopher, however, raises some fundamental problems, which I would like to address in the remainder of this discussion. To begin with, his account seems to ignore the negative valence given to empeiria as a sort of false knowledge by Plato himself in the well-known debate with Polus in the Gorgias. In that dialogue, empeiria was the sort of knack, as it's been translated, for pleasing their listeners that sophists possessed, and was set in contrast to episteme, the true knowledge of what they needed. Just as cookery attended to the pleasures of the palate, so rhetoric attended to the pleasures of the ear, in Plato's account. As Plotinus later would declare, the soul became ugly when it attended inordinately to the things of this embodied life, as though it were smearing itself with mud. This is in his Essay on Beauty, and he's borrowing, of course, an image from Plato's Republic. Porphyry likewise had adopted the same metaphor in his Against Boethus, where he described the soul as covered with base matter, which needed to be chipped away like dirt surrounding gold. The fragments of his On the Return of the Soul echo with the declaration, or at least they echo in Augustine, with the declaration that we must flee the body. The philosopher should avoid the tumult of food and smells, of smoke and blood, and the material daimones that crowd around the participant of a sacrifice at a civic festival. The sacrificial appeasements of the city have, he said, nothing to do with us. There is, therefore, a tension between this flight from the world and his call for the investigation of the world within a single treatise as well as within his larger corpus of writings. Yet we should recall that the tension is one that is native to Plato's dialogues themselves. While Plato saw embodiment as falling into mud, forgetting, falling asleep, getting drunk, or as death itself, he had also made much use of bodily metaphors, even for the soul's post-mortem existence, and expressed a rich sense for the literary and philosophical attractiveness of pausing over the beauty of bodies. As one discovers in the Symposium and the Phaedrus, beautiful bodies can prompt desire for true intelligible beauties, or at least stir one's memory of intelligible realities. The body was a site simultaneously of temptation and promise. It is the more hopeful approach, or the more optimistic approach, that Porphyry expresses in his connection of the philosophical and historical tasks in the On Abstinence. Indeed, he exquisitely observes in this respect that, quote, these practices, namely honey libations, which was under discussion at that point, are still preserved among some peoples, like traces of the truth, end quote. Not only were the present practices indications confirming the historical claims of their ancient antecedents, but both were indications of the truth of the friendship and kinship of humans and animals. Because lower beings participated in the higher levels of an ontological hierarchy, they contained hints and reflections of those higher realities, diffuse and distorted, of course, and always in need of interpretation by the researcher who practiced true philosophy. It is this participation and mimesis that opened up the philosophical necessity of doing history, and doing it carefully and thoroughly, especially given the dangers of doing bad history and bad philosophy. Porphyry seems to have gone even further. The examination of history prevented bad philosophy. In several passages of different works, he opposes the sophistic proliferation of logoi, or arguments, that perpetuate and arise from poor reasoning and conjecture. In his treatise Tagaris on the ensoulment of embryos, he claims that a particular argument for the soul's uniting with the body before separation from the mother is based on, quote, abstract argument. I'm using Wilberding's translation here. Abstract argument, or logos, which can easily supply an abundance of false and misleading claims, as well as eliminate the truth by appealing to plausible likelihood, end quote. In attacking another group of opponents in the same work, he accuses them of not basing their claims on, quote, clear evidence, but rather conjectures and probabilities, end quote. Such criticisms, connecting conjecture to philosophically suspect argument or logos, recur in the Epistle to Anebo and the Against the Christians, where Greek philosophers and the Christian origin are attacked in turn. Historia becomes an antidote to the conjectural argumentation of sophists. While it may be impossible to reconstruct the overall argument of the four-book Against Boethus on the immortality of the soul, it appears that this philosophical significance of Historia is what is being alluded to in a tantalizing fragment, which I quote in full. This is the second one, and I've already alluded to it earlier. The evidence of our thoughts and that of history unquestionably establish the immortality of the soul, but the arguments brought forward by the philosophers in demonstration of it seem easy to be overthrown through the ingenious arguments of the heuristics on every subject, or just of disputatious people. For what argument in philosophy could not be disputed by men of different opinion, of heterodox opinion, when some of them thought fit to suspend judgment even about matters that seemed to be manifest? Without the restraint fostered by historical research, mere argumentation, especially by those who argue without commitment to truth, leads to heterodoxy. The invoking of Archimedes' machines, mentioned at the opening of the present discussion, may gesture at the ways history was to aid philosophy. Consideration of the great mathematician's divine nature confirmed the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, eternally moving in its orbit, like the orbits of the planets, in ways reminiscent of the demiurgic narrative of Plato's Timaeus. A clearer and more extensive demonstration of the importance of history for philosophy occurs, of course, in the On Abstinence. Those who see sacrificial practices as an excuse to indulge in meat-eating must be corrected by an appreciation of the history of sacrifice as one of decline from vegetal to animal sacrifices. Similarly, the sophistical Greeks of his own time, who in Book 4 of the On Abstinence complain of the austere asceticism of vegetarianism, can be silenced by the compilation of historical research on the dietary practices of Egyptian priests, Jewish sages, or Indian holy men that forms the bulk of that book. The logoi of bad philosophy had to be checked by the details of history. We may recall that it was the immature use of logoi that led to sophistry in the same book of Plato's Republic, which describes the soul's embodiment as a falling into the mud. This is Book 7 of the Republic. Historia provided a means of wiping away the mud. I think one could say that, for Porphyry, Historia, the careful examination of the minutiae of embodied existence, both past and present, provides a sort of epistemological therapy for the embodied soul. One may know best how to flee from bodies if one performs a meticulous examination into the nature and habits of bodies in particular times and places. After all, the fragmentary treatise that had preached the flight from all bodies, namely the On the Return of the Soul, claims to have drawn its conclusions from historical investigation. As it turns out, the investigation brought negative results. There was no universal way to liberate the soul. Whether the via universalis here is taken as a reference to the search for a path of salvation for all people, philosopher and commoner alike, or as a path of salvation for the whole soul, the intellectual and the spiritual parts together, it was some sort of historical investigation into the rituals and doctrines of the Chaldeans, Indians, and others that led Porphyry to reject the possibility of such a path. Indeed, the anecdote of a Chaldean theurgist whose methods backfired led to, or at least confirmed, a philosophical discomfort with theurgy in this treatise, just as research into oracles showed their prophecies to be the products of misleading astrology in the philosophy from oracles, or inquiry into Egyptian priestly practices in theology evinced skepticism about the philosophical precision or benefit to the performance of many popular religious forms in his Epistle to Aneba. It is difficult to discern the precise motivations behind Porphyry's composition of the philosophical history. Could he have written it as a sort of epistemological therapy for the embodied soul? Our answer to this question will have to grapple with the widely differing nature of the fragments of that work. Even though the so-called Life of Pythagoras provides us with a fairly large chunk of one of that text's original books, and even though a majority of the fragments from the remaining books come from the same source, namely Cyril of Alexandria, that source is a Christian author engaged in an elaborate polemic against Julian the Apostate and seems to have different goals in his citation of the different books of the philosophical history, while the larger Life of Pythagoras provides us with a diverse and often unclear interweaving of Porphyry's own sources for that segment of the work. I do hope it is clear from the foregoing considerations of the On Abstinence that it is not improbable to suppose that significant philosophical aims may have been behind the odd philosophical history, as well as many of his other treatises of varying rhetorical or intellectual purpose and tone. Rarely among the intellectuals of the imperial and late antique eras, voluminous though the literary output of some of them was, does the modern reader meet a figure who wrote on so many subjects and contributed to so many fields of inquiry as Porphyry of Tyre. Part of the reason we possess works from his hand on so many topics, replete with historical anecdotes and ethnographic peculiarities, is that Porphyry remained convinced of the significance of doing historia as an integral part of doing philosophy. Whether it was the singularity of a mathematical genius's planetarium, a humble peasant's pinches of a simple grain offering, the chronological relationship of the seven sages to the Trojan War, the trials by ordeal of Brahmin philosophers in the mountains of India, or the pithy saying of a contemporary philosopher. All such details available through investigation into the lives of embodied souls provided traces, however faint, of more sublime truths and higher realities for the philosopher who identified himself as a historian of many things. Thank you for your